Welcome to the fourth podcast in the Foreign Policy Association series of six conversations on U.S.-China relations. This is Sarwar Kashmiri, inviting you to join me in conversation with Professor Toshi Yoshihara, who holds the John A. Van Buren Chair of Asia-Pacific Studies at the United States Naval War College. Dr. Yoshihara has also served as an analyst at the Institute for Foreign Policy Analysis of the RAND Corporation and the American Enterprise Institute. He's the author or co-author of numerous books, including Red Star Over the Pacific, China's Rise and Challenge to U.S. Maritime Strategy, Indian Naval Strategy in the 21st Century, and Chinese Naval Strategy in the 21st Century. One technical note, during this conversation, you will hear the word EEZ, which stands for Exclusive Economic Zone, that extends 200 miles from a country's shore. The Law of the Sea Treaty gives a country total sovereignty for 12 miles from its shoreline, an area called the country's territorial sea. Beyond the territorial sea for 200 miles, the EEZ gives the country rights to the resources under the water, but the treaty considers the surface of the waters an international zone that can be navigated by all. Dr. Yoshihara joins me from his offices at the Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island. So, Professor Yoshihara, there was recently a decision by the Court of Arbitration against China's claims to a large part of the South China Sea. Do you think this was a big deal? Do you think that this had any great impact on the situation or the relationship between the two?
I think the tribunal's ruling is a big deal, and it's a big deal because I think it sets the record straight in terms of the international law's view of China's claim, which is that the decision made quite clear that China's claims were excessive, and that once China signed on to the UN Law of the Sea Convention, that China's signing that treaty meant that the Chinese claims about their historic rights in the South China Sea were superseded by the Law of the Sea Treaty.
Right.
And so in that sense, this represented a major diplomatic and legal setback for China. On the other hand, I think that China is standing firm and has essentially articulated that it will not back down from its claims, that it doesn't recognize the jurisdictional authority of the tribunal, and that it will do nothing to enforce or to follow the court's ruling.
Haven't big powers done that before? I mean, the United States, as someone pointed out, the same court ruled against the United States when Nicaragua brought a case against it, and the United States just shrugged it away and said Nicaragua really has no claim to such a action. So what is different with China?
Sure. I think that's certainly one argument that has been advanced, which is that what China is doing is no different from other great powers that have chosen to ignore international rulings that are either inconvenient or rulings that the great power does not agree with. So this isn't simply to pinpoint China as sort of the bad guy in this, because, of course, other great powers have, you know, followed their own will on these matters as well. But I think it's also important to know that great powers have, though over time, changed their policies, adjusted their postures in ways that gradually conform to those international rulings.
Right.
And so it's possible to expect that China would do something similar. And so in some ways, I see the ruling as a big deal to another extent, which is that this essentially resets the conversation. It resets the discourse,
uh-huh.
Which is now that we have the international court ruling on this issue, it creates essentially a benchmark by which the international community can measure China's progress towards aligning its policies towards the ruling. So this isn't really the final word on this issue. In some ways, I see the ruling, and I think Chinese scholars have commented that the ruling essentially resets the conversation.
I see.
And that it kind of clears the table, and then I think this becomes the basis by which we can measure China's moves towards the tribunal's ruling, or to what extent China will continue to refuse to acknowledge both the jurisdiction but also the substance of the ruling.
Do you think that in hindsight, the American strategy, the so-called pivot to Asia, was a mistake in that it so threatened China that it pushed the nine-dash line and created all of this confrontation? That do you think if that pivot had not been announced, that things would be a lot more amicable between the two?
Yeah, you know, I think this issue about the effect of the U.S. pivot or rebalance to Asia and its impact on Chinese threat perceptions, I think this gets us into a classic chicken or egg argument, which is who started it first. And I think if you take this argument too far, you can roll the clock all the way back to, you know, the Cold War or even before to trace, you know, who started the action-reaction cycle. But I think it's important to note that China was already beginning to act in a fairly aggressive way years before the rebalance or the pivot was announced in early 2012. So if you go back to some of the more provocative maritime incidents, like the Chinese intercept of the U.S. NS Impeccable off the South China Sea, that happened in 2009. The tiff between China and Japan over a Chinese fishing captain that sailed into the waters around the Senkaku Islands.
Right.
He was arrested by the Japanese Coast Guard, and then it plunged Sino-Japanese relationship to very new lows. That happened in 2010. So I think we can point to a whole host of actions taken by China that preceded the so-called pivot. And so it's hard to pinpoint the exact cause for who started the downward spiral in Sino-U.S. maritime relations.
I see. The point is always made by the United States that the U.S. must maintain power there so that there is freedom of navigation. And a lot of people wonder why the Chinese, because of their huge commercial relationships, ever want to do anything to disrupt freedom of navigation. So is there really any validity to the U.S. insistence on why it has its carrier fleets out there?
Certainly the Chinese have insisted that China has never opposed freedom of navigation,
right,
and that China has a stake in maintaining freedom of navigation because it depends on it for its economic well-being. But I think it's important to read kind of between the lines or to read more carefully what the Chinese mean by freedom of navigation, because I think they have a very different interpretation of that concept compared to the United States and really the vast majority of the international community. From the perspective of the United States, freedom of navigation is the natural condition of the sea, and that the freedom of navigation applies to all things that must travel by sea. That includes both commercial, military, scientific vessels that travel international waters.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas China's interpretation is much more narrowly confined, meaning that freedom of navigation really applies to commercial shipping. Whereas I think they have a much more restrictive reading of, say, military vessels and scientific research vessels that are operating in waters that China can assert certain jurisdictional rights. And so that's quite a narrow interpretation that's really at odds against how the United States views freedom of navigation. And I think this has important implications because from the U.S. perspective, as the, in some ways, the underwriter of global security and as the underwriter of access to the open commons, to the global commons, which is so essential to the globalization process, is that you need to use hard power to underwrite that openness. Ultimately, the final arbiter of having free access to the seas is having a strong navy that can make sure that those seas remain open. So China's more restrictive interpretation of freedom of navigation, which means that it has the right to restrict foreign military vessels from operating in waters that it believes are its own, goes against that principle. And so I think while on the surface it may seem like the United States is potentially overreacting to China's posture, since China clearly has no intention of blocking access to the seas, I think a more careful reading of how the Chinese interpret that freedom helps to explain why the United States, I think justifiably, is concerned about China's policy in the maritime domain.
So, Professor Yoshihara, from what you've said, I could then conclude that if the Chinese patrol the Atlantic Ocean by New York and Florida and set up bases in St. Croix and elsewhere, that they would be within their quote-unquote legal rights for doing so, and that the United States would not view it as a threat?
Absolutely. I think this is one of the things that I've often been asked by my Chinese interlocutors, which is, you know, how would you feel if my Navy went up to the, you know, to just outside of America's territorial waters off the coast of California? How would you feel, right? And the implication there is that the United States holds inherently a double standard, that the United States thinks it's okay to operate in China's backyard, but that it would react very negatively if China operated in America's backyard. My answer to that argument or that assertion is, please come. Please come to the American West Coast, or please come around to our Atlantic seaboard.
Really?
Because you will see that the United States will, in fact, treat you just as it would be expected to be treated in China's backyard. And I think the Cold War example is a good one. We know that the Soviet Union operated their aircraft and their naval vessels very close to America's shores. Now, certainly the United States didn't like it and did its best to keep track of those assets. But the United States never objected to the principle that the Soviet Union had the freedom to operate in those bodies of waters that are essentially international air and sea space. And I would expect that the United States would respond in a very similar way if China one day possessed the capacity to project power out into America's backyard. And in fact, we do have an example of a double standard exercised by China, which is that China objects to American naval vessels operating in its EEZ, and yet when Chinese naval vessels operated in Hawaii's EEZ, the United States didn't object to that. The United States said, the Chinese naval vessels were, in fact, operating within the law, and that, you know, it was conducting normal operations in our EEZ. So I think, in this case, I think the double standard could be turned on China. Which is that it has, again, it would not allow outsiders to operate in its EEZ while it expects to be able to operate freely in other countries' EEZ.
You've been listening to a conversation with Toshi Yoshihara, recorded for the Foreign Policy Association's podcast series on U.S.-China relations. The music on all these podcasts was performed by the Norwich University Regimental Band, the oldest collegiate regimental band in America. We invite you to tune in next conversation in this series. Until then, this is your host, Sarwar Kashmiri. Thank you for listening.